This is a 720 to go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
As one of the world's largest agricultural processors, ADM is uniquely positioned to serve the world's growing needs for abundant food and renewable energy. ADM.
When it comes to the business of America's farmland, you need the information from the people who know it best. That's why we bring you AgriCast with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong.
Hey, old-timer, remember when we had, had a spring? I mean, when spring actually got here in April.
And stayed.
Yeah, it was amazing back in those days.
Yeah, I know over the last few years it's been, and you know my garden I used to have, but I would hate to go out to the garden to try to do anything until it was May. Because we knew this was going to happen.
It is just rather remarkable. I heard Mr. Skilling say this week we've had what, the most snow events for an early April in more than a decade. I think he said.
I think that was right.
I want to say he said about 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I was going down 88 the other day, and all of a sudden, wham! You're in sleet. And then, you know, another mile later, you're in the snow.
Yeah, not good at all.
The black ice concern you pointed out that we need to be watchful of this morning for sure.
Definitely.
Thank you, sir. We'll talk to you a little bit later.
Yes, sir.
Roger Badish in the WGN Newsroom. Max Armstrong with you on this Saturday morning. The Big O extending his vacation period. We were laughing about it on our television show this week at Agribusiness that Orion had stretched the birthday vacation to 3 weeks this year. But why not? You know, make the most of it, I say. We'll, a little bit later on this morning, be talking about that proposed rail line that would come through the Chicago area, the Great Lakes Basin, it is called. And we'll talk about the route. And I tweeted over the past hour where that, just where that line would go. And it's a remarkable geography in our region when you take a look at where the line would stretch. From over in LaPorte County, Indiana, to up in Rock County, Wisconsin. But we'll discuss that a little bit in the second half hour of the Saturday morning show this morning. Not much planning going on because of this kind of wintry weather. And not just precipitation, the doggone soils are so cool yet. We'll visit with a farm broadcaster friend from the Springfield area to get a report from him whether or not they've been able to plant down that way. You know, generally this time of the year, you'll find temperatures so much warmer in central Illinois on many days than in the Chicago area. I mean, you know, it's not at all unusual, it seems, to have temperatures in the 70s, maybe in that Springfield-Decatur line. And by the time you get to Kankakee, it's 60. And you get into the western suburbs, it might be 55. And downtown, 45 because of the lake this time of year. And those winds out of the northeast, the doggone wind has been a part of the story, too. I saw a Facebook posting this week from, it would have been, I guess, northern Iroquois County or southern Kankakee County, and those sandy soils, and the wind was really whipping up that top sand, I guess you would call it, in that particular region. We'll talk about markets coming up here momentarily, visiting with Rich Nelson from Allendale Incorporated. In the wake of the big planting intentions report that rocked the market a week ago, corn actually clawed its way back up some during the week. Soybeans ended up with a gain yesterday of about a dozen cents a bushel. We'll talk about some of the factors behind that. Speaking of weather and crops and markets, they're wringing their hands over the wheat crop again. We didn't talk about that with Rich this week, but they did that tour, the Kansas Wheat Commission, Kansas wheat growers, looking at the crop, and they say there are three major hurdles out there. One of those is the crop is 3 weeks ahead of normal, so that makes it very susceptible to damage. They have some disease pressure out there. Stripe rust is one of the diseases in the wheat, one of the diseases in the wheat crop that they're concerned about. And the drought conditions. If you take a look at the drought monitor map of the United States, one thing that you'll notice is there's kind of an impressive area in the Plain States, the Midlands region, where it's starting to get awful dry. Abnormally dry is the indicator on that drought monitor map when you look at a region from southern Missouri through Kansas, down into areas of Oklahoma and Texas. Of course, the pendulum can swing dramatically when you're just abnormally dry, but that is something that some of the folks in the grain trade are watching. They're also they're talking a lot about La Nina. Some of the meteorologists upping the chances of a La Nina occurrence now that they see El Nino dissipating. What does that mean? Well, La Nina is often associated with very dry and hot growing conditions here on the North American continent. So that gets some people thinking about, oh yeah, we might have a drought this summer. If there isn't one, look out. Prices will more rapidly decline, no doubt, because of the big crops that we've had, the abundance of production that we have, and the not-so-robust demand to handle all of those crops. We'll talk a little bit more about the markets coming up here, and again, we'll check on the condition. I may talk about food waste a little bit as well, because that's looming larger on the radar screen. An interesting story in Feedstuffs magazine about that. All that and more here on the Saturday Morning Show from WGN Radio.
Joining us this weekend, the chief strategist at Allendale Incorporated, Rich Nelson. Rich, as you visit with the growers, they're ready to go, aren't they? They, as soon as the weather permits, will be in the field, will they not?
Oh, there's no doubt. In fact, this past weekend, I took a tour around a good portion of the Midwest, in fact, and saw, I want to say, one out of every three farms had tractors and planters sitting out, ready to go, of course, doing maintenance, getting things ready here. But as a whole, most producers are looking forward to restarting the whole brand new here in front of us. We saw a lot of exciting stuff going on. And like I mentioned, a lot of guys looking forward, of course, to this challenging year ahead of us, but certainly looking forward to brand new year ahead of us.
One thing I really enjoy this time of year and during harvest, too, is producers sharing video clips from the cab. And there was one sent to me on Twitter this week by Delbert Armstrong, Armstrong Farms in Hyde County, North Carolina. He's right next to the Atlantic Ocean. And as he showed that vista around toward the back of his tractor there to see the planter, there was dust. There was dust coming up from that planter, and it looked like he was planting in very good conditions. Indeed, the planting season is underway in those southern and southeast states.
That's right. Aside from a few states, you know, for instance, your Mississippi, your Alabamas, and Louisiana, most other states are looking right now at normal conditions, if not actually maybe a little dry in some areas. So we're going to have a very productive, very fast planting here as we get up into the Nebraska area here, southern Missouri as well. We will have some challenges, though. Like I said, here as far as the southern states, you have a few select ones which will have problems. In addition, you have the Indiana-Ohio areas, which have seen above-normal precip here in the past few months, and that could provide some minor challenges for those farmers.
You mentioned Alabama and Mississippi. I saw a map the other day that showed how many severe weather warnings have occurred across the United States so far, year to date. And those two states really had been a focus of a lot of weather patterns, severe weather, and as you point out, I guess, quite a bit of moisture.
That's exactly right. In fact, over the past 3 months, these two states, particularly here, these guys have had 6 inches more than normal in the past 3 months. So they are certainly well suited right now for moisture. The problem is, of course, getting some dry weather and getting some planting done for those guys.
There might have been the need to even replant. I had pointed out a few weeks back, I talked to a farmer at Commodity Classic who was from Louisiana, and he had already planted on his farm north of New Orleans, and then that big deluge of moisture came through, so I would imagine there was some chance to replant there. You mentioned the dry area, and I noticed on the drought monitor map, the geography is becoming a little more impressive there. I mean, when you're talking about Kansas, you're talking about Missouri, you know, it's not a severe drought, but it's abnormally dry.
That's exactly right. In fact, what's been really interesting is this has really just shown up in the past 3 weeks, perhaps, for those areas. And that's something we weren't expecting here. But as we know, as far as our planting pace concerns, though, anything that's dry is certainly going to be a very productive pace once they do get in the field here. So that's a big question for us right now.
Well, let me ask you about this, about market interest in planting weather. Last year, the Eastern Corn Belt, everything you could throw at that crop was thrown at it in terms of bad planting weather. Guess what? We wound up with good production after all was said and done. Now, the individual farmers, of course, in that region, it was a struggle, by all means. It was not a fun planting season. They don't want to relive that again. But isn't the market more likely to start assuming, wait a minute, we're going to get this crop in. We're going to have a good-sized crop. We've seen in the past that planting seasons can go remarkably well, even though there's a lot of hand-wringing over it.
That's actually a great point. In the past 10 years, we've seen quite a few instances of these late planting years where magically, somehow, the acreage does get in, does actually get in here. So we know that the market will have some quick little jiggles in the market, some little rallies here, maybe in the next 2 or 3 weeks, 2 or 3 months here. But as a whole, generally, what they intend to plant has been put in the field here in the past few years.
That planting intentions report pretty much snuffed out the opportunity for any kind of significant planting rally, did it not?
And that's a great point. We probably won't see a major rally overall in grains as we go into spring. We may see some changes in the mix, though, as far as pricing. Perhaps you can argue maybe some corn acres will switch over to beans, which is the current trade talk, maybe 1 to 2 million acres. But that probably won't cause any major reason to rally yet. The real issues ahead of us are going to be yield. Before this actual planting report, we had corn maybe offering a $40 premium over soybean revenue here, and I'm going to say that's a $40 premium. That's going to be less loss, keep in mind, as far as that goes. But now we've probably changed that to where now it's probably even, if not actually slightly favoring soybeans by a very small amount here. So we probably have influenced a minor change in acreage, no doubt here.
You talk to the input suppliers, and they say, in a quiet personal conversation, they'll say, yeah, producers are trying to find ways to cut back by all means. How significant is that in terms of the final yield? In other words, is there enough trimming back of various crop inputs, fertilizers, fertilizer enhancers, yield enhancers, that it could make any kind of a significant difference in the ultimate yield? I mean, we hear some people throwing out some big corn yield numbers out there if the weather cooperates. I know there was one highly regarded Iowa meteorologist, climatologist who threw out 173 bushel corn yield out there the other day.
I'm probably going to take a little different tack than that viewpoint here. Now, in terms of yield, the issues in front of us as far as inputs and as far as seed and seed quality and seed varieties for the nationwide interest, which is what we're looking at here, I have personally never been able to find any correlation between changes in seed mix or changes in inputs used on a year-to-year basis. The issues which really determine nationwide yield are temperatures and moisture at the exact particular times here. So as far as ourselves, we're using more of a reasonable trend line, 165 right now, and that's if we get average weather. Now keep in mind, nobody's calling for average weather this summer. You have NOAA calling for above normal temps, or the private guys who are calling for slightly below normal precip in the Western Corn Belt.
Well, how long do you think it'll be before we really see some excitement in the weather?
Our kind of plan right now overall is that, you know, we will have some minor problems with planting. We may have some rallies here or there, but bottom line, we're probably going to go back down in terms of pricing once we get this crop planted down in that May, early June time frame, right back to where we started from in this corn market, this 350 range, soybean side of things here, maybe this 870 range or so. But our big issues in terms of the first part of your question, when does the rally get started? Traditionally, it's been the second or third week of June for these type of summer rallies. So on that aspect, I wouldn't look for a rally right now, but maybe later on, yes.
How's the demand front looking at the moment? We know it has not been terribly impressive, but typically low prices encourage additional buying. What's happening there?
We actually have seen some changes. You know, according to this last grain stocks report, once you compute out, you take out the exports, you take out the corn for ethanol, we actually saw a very good feed residual use. In fact, 7% more than last year at the exact same time. So low prices are garnering some interest, and we certainly would suggest for this this next report we have lined up next week from USDA, the monthly supply demand, that will be addressed. Now, while we're seeing some good domestic demand, our question right now, as far as corn go, are exports. We're still suggesting USDA may need to lower that here on the coming report.
Feed and residual use. Talk a little bit about that category. Is that one that's a little bit of a struggle to get your arms around sometimes?
It is always a struggle for any analyst and anyone looking at the market to guess here. As far as the big picture issues on feed residual, keep in mind there's no weekly reports, unlike exports. There's no monthly reports, unlike we get in for corn for ethanol or, for instance, soybeans for crush. So it's a big black hole category that we really can't argue with USDA on because it's just a tough one for us to figure out. So in general, number one, we've got more birds, more hogs, and a little more cattle. Number two, we have cheap corn. That'll be slightly offset by the higher feed availability of other minor grains and DDGs.
It's always great to have you as a guest here, sir. Come back soon. We'll talk to you sometime, maybe during more exciting days of the growing season, one can hope.
Sounds great. Look forward to it.
Rich Nelson, Allendale Incorporated.
Saturday morning show from WGN Radio. We've broken out the baling wire and masking tape and tying it all together here, trying to keep this big old combine running. Man, I'm telling you. We will, in the next hour, talk a bit about that railroad. The next half hour, talk about that proposed rail line, the Great Lakes Basin rail line. Kind of an interesting story, by all means, that we'll visit there. But we've talked often about the Environmental Protection Agency, and we've heard some of the critics of the EPA talking about it being an agency out of control. There was an interesting editorial that appeared this week in a newspaper out in the Northwest United States about how the EPA has been funding anti-farmer billboards. Yeah, this has been going on in Washington State. Some billboards were popping up critical of the agriculture industry, and this was from groups like the, quote, Puget Sound Keeper, the Western Environmental Law Center, the Center for Environmental Law and Policy. And it turns out the billboards, $570,000 for these billboards, the money was coming from tax dollars, from the EPA. And there was no disclaimer on the billboards pointing out that the source of the grant to make the billboards possible was the Environmental Protection Agency. And that is against the rules of the EPA, because if there is such a grant, it needs to be stipulated in the ads. But the farmers are saying the ads shouldn't be there to begin with. They say that they continue to be amazed at politically motivated billboards, an attack on the agriculture industry, and funded by tax dollars. So that's another reason for the farmers in that part of the country to not be very fond of the Environmental Protection Agency. We'll see what Big O has to say in his commentary coming up after the news right here on Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. Thanks, Roger. Appreciate it. As is the case every Saturday morning on the morning show, we hear from the Big O as he weighs in on Samuels and says it's sponsored by Wink Products.
Welcome to Samuelson Says. Hello, everyone. I'm Orion Samuelson. This week, looking at another group that wants to change the lives of chickens.
The folks at Wink Products Company want to help make your life easier with a family of professional strength cleaning products that really work. Wink Rust Stain Remover is the number one liquid rust stain remover in the country. This professional strength formula dissolves the ugly rust stains on white sinks and toilet bowls, color-fast fabrics, and carpets. This little brown bottle has been around for 69 years, and it's still number one. To learn where to find quality Wink products, check us out at WHINK.com.
You have heard me say this before on Samuelson Says. If you and your family own your farm or ranch, you're no longer farming it alone. A lot of other people want to join you in determining how you produce food, fiber, and energy. There are many government agencies that now get involved in your business, from OSHA to EPA, from USDA, from the Bureau of Land Management. And then there are many other groups, animal rights and environmental groups, that get involved. And I guess the latest has me really shaking my head to the point where I'm going to quote the story that appeared on my Reuters news service a few weeks ago. The headline, Whole Foods Changes the Chicken Game. And let me read verbatim. Whole Foods Market is changing the chicken game with its most recent move to replace its fast-growing chicken breeds with slower-growing breeds. Although the change is not expected to be completed until 2024, Whole Foods is the first major food company to make this change. Now, the company is working with the Global Animal Partnership, known as GAP, in this collaboration. And in a separate release, GAP announced its intention over the next 8 years to replace 100% of fast-growing chicken breeds with slower-growing chicken breeds. Over 600 chicken farms currently use the GAP standard, affecting the lives of 277 million chickens annually, making it the most significant higher welfare farm animal standard in the country. And here's what the director says. Currently, fast-growing chicken breeds represent 98% of all commercially available chicken meat in North America. Modern chickens have been genetically selected for their fast, efficient growth and higher yield of breast meat. However, this has had detrimental impacts on the welfare of broiler chickens, including immune problems, resulting in limitations to the bird's ability to express natural behaviors like perching, flying, and even walking. And, of course, the first person to applaud the move, Wayne Pacelli of Humane Society of the United States. Give me a break. My thoughts on Samuelson says.
Well, you'll be hearing a lot about a proposed rail line that would go through the countryside, not far from Chicago, but it wouldn't go through Chicago. And that's the intent, they say, those private investors who would build the Great Lakes Basin Railroad. It would be a bypass of Chicago. And understandably, a lot of folks are concerned about it out in the countryside where that rail line would cross through at least three counties of Indiana, and I believe six or seven in northern Illinois and one in Wisconsin. That's a lot of geography, of course, in our region. Carl Zimmerman joins me on the line to talk about it. Carl, I understand you folks are getting together, understandably, to oppose this, those of you who would be adversely affected.
Yes, we've been forming pretty rapidly out here with different social media groups, mainly using Facebook to get together. Every county has formed a subgroup off of the main groups, and we've all banded together to try to get out information as much as possible to people and try to inform the masses, because there wasn't a whole lot of news on this as of 3 weeks ago.
Talk a little bit about the route that this rail line would take. I mentioned that it would start in northwestern Indiana. I understand it would go through LaPorte and Porter and Lake counties. What would be the path through the northern part of Illinois?
It would run through Kankakee County into Grundy County, cutting diagonally across LaSalle County, and then going around DeKalb to go up through Lee County to Ogle County, and then one into Ogle County, basically on the south side of Rockford. There will be a spur line going into the Rockford Airport, which would run into Winnebago County, and then out and up through Boone County.
278 miles, 278, I think, is what I saw. Is that correct?
Yes.
It would be an $8 billion project, and this is not governments getting together to do this. This is private enterprise, from what I hear.
Exactly, and that's what we're fighting against. This is not a Class 1 rail carrier that's proposing to do this. This is a group of private speculative investors that feel like they need to put this rail bypass around Chicago.
The basis, as I understand it, is that it takes so long for a freight train to move through Chicago, and especially for the movement of produce from the West Coast to the East Coast, they get those hot trains, sometimes they call them, would get bogged down going through Chicago. But didn't they put some kind of a flyover, some kind of a rail remedy in place in Chicago sometime in the past couple of years to try to take care of that?
Yes, they have the CREATE program, which is still not fully utilized yet. They still haven't finished that project. A lot of their keystones are at-grade separations, flyover over busy roads, busy intersections, rail separation for Metra Amtrak trains as opposed to the freight trains running through there. Last I looked, they still had quite a few projects that they are trying to get done.
There is a lot of movement on the rail lines through Chicago, to be sure, especially when you talk about all of those trains, the freight, the Amtrak, the Metro system. They have to share the lines, and it can really get bogged down, indeed, as we understand it. But this bypass would carry more than 100 trains a day, from what I read.
That's what that's what we're calling the Great Lakes Basin's website. We call them GLB. That's what they're proposing, that there could be up to 110 trains a day on this rail, which would be basically one every 13 to 15 minutes.
And these probably wouldn't be short trains in many instances.
No. Where I actually live at, northern LaSalle County, the Burlington Northern Santa Fe tracks are approximately three-quarters of a mile behind my house, and we have roughly 70 to 80 trains passing through there a day. We all understand progress. However, they're not showing us a total demand for the use of this rail. In fact, in the Chicago Tribune, there was an article, I think it was March 22nd, where Union Pacific has stated they have no interest in pursuing this project alongside a Great Lakes Basin.
That's very interesting. How many tracks would there be? Are they talking about double tracks or triple tracks for this line?
For most of the route, it will be double tracks. The track rolling through Rock County and Boone County would be a single. Through LaSalle County, through Lee County would be doubles. In areas, though, they will have sidings. North of Route 30 in Lee County, there's actually, according to the map that's been provided by the Surface Transportation Board, there would be up to six rails as sidings, probably anywhere from 7 to 8 miles long.
One could imagine that there will be many instances where these rails cross at the grade with highways. I mean, I can't imagine that they've priced into this project the expense of overpasses and underpasses, have they?
No. I think what they're looking at is possibly having the state and local county governments take care of this. We live off of Route 34 out here. And they're proposing to have an overpass over there just to keep the traffic safe, not tie up anybody. But road projects are very hard to get started and get finished, especially in a given economy. Also, what they're proposing as far as GLB is to put in a flyover over competing railroad tracks, so the Burlington Northern Santa Fe tracks or the Union Pacific tracks, so the trains don't have to wait for each other at those crossings. The amount of borrow pits that would have to be dug to build these flyovers would be astronomical.
Well, there's one concern that I would imagine farmland owners would have. Have you talked to some of the farmers around there, and have you heard what they're saying about it? What else worries them?
What's going to happen to the drainage in the area as far as field tiles being crushed, affecting the natural landscape so the water cannot move correctly off of it? Another thing is the closure, possible closure of township roads, making it harder for farmers to get from field to field without going on main roads and slowing up traffic, increasing the probability of having a ag equipment versus car accident. One big thing that we've been pushing is what's going to happen to our volunteer first responders. They're going to have to reroute to try to get to possible house fire, car accidents, and it's going to take them a lot longer as these township roads are closed.
Just the nightmare of getting into the fields and having fields cut up by this rail line. I can imagine farmers would be very, very concerned about the proposal. What's the process? How will it move along here now, Carl? What is the likely path that it will take?
Right now, what we are in is the STB, Transportation Board, is asking for public comments. They have scoping meetings coming up here in the next 2 weeks in various locations all along the line. And it's an ability for people to go out, voice their concerns on what this could do to the area as far as environmental issues, socioeconomic issues. Also, they are accepting letters at Surface Transportation Board, so people can write letters stating their issues. If they're not comfortable with getting in front of people and talking, they can go ahead and write a letter. They can do it via email. And we're just trying to stress to everybody to get out and make our voices be heard on this project.
Have any state lawmakers or federal officials weighed in on this, to your knowledge, Carl?
Not yet. They're taking a wait and look at this because the project has kind of seemed to sprung up out of nowhere. With talking with local government officials, they were caught off guard, very surprised. I've met with a couple of county boards already that had no idea this was going to happen.
The Surface Transportation Board, do you have any feel for how quickly they might act on something like this?
Right now, the public comment, we just got an extension to June 16th here in the last couple hours. What they'll do is take comments up until that time. After June 16th, there will be no more public comments made. However, it'll be a long process for them to wade through all this And that's when they will try to decide, do they give Great Lakes Basin an exemption to an environmental study? Do they make them do an environmental study, or do they just kill the project altogether?
How does it work when somebody, when private enterprise wants to come through with a rail line, can they utilize eminent domain and condemn the land and just go right on through? How does that work, Carl?
Actually, according to legal counsel that I've talked to with various groups, GLB is not entitled to eminent domain. They are not a railroad company. They are strictly a transportation company. They are threatening to use eminent domain, but unless state and federal law is changed or amended, they legally have no right to eminent domain.
Is there a map where somebody could go online and see what this path might be? Our discussion, of course, has centered on the counties, but I'm sure a lot of folks would like to see the actual path, what towns that would be near this planned line. And is there a website and a Facebook page?
Yes, probably the best resource as far as the map would be Great Lakes Basin EIS. That is actually the Surface Transportation Board map. They use Google Earth, they overlay where the proposed rail is going to go through, and you can pull it up and look section by section, see the houses where it's going to cut close to people's yards. We do have a Facebook page, which is Block GLB Railroad, and then we also have a website, which is www.blockglbrailroad.com.
Give me that first address that you gave that you would suggest someone might Google.
Great Basin EIS.
You think about projects that the farm landowners have had to fight, and many they have been able to battle successfully for one reason or another. Maybe it was the economic challenge that proved to be the death knell for some of these things, some of them transportation related. But this could really, really shake up a lot of farmers that would be affected in the path of that rail line.
It could forever alter the way we do business in northern Illinois.
And I come back to your comment about the first responders. The challenge that these rural departments, many of them operating on very tight budgets to begin with. This time of the year, some of them have to have pancake breakfasts on a Sunday morning to try to keep turnout gear for the volunteers. And the stress that they would face just having to try to re-diagram their districts, the mutual aid that would be required to cover because they can't get directly to a scene, that would be a nightmare.
Yes, I've got a lot of good friends that are on the volunteer fire department here locally, and it would just be a flat-out nightmare for them. These people that volunteer to do this are my heroes. To go out any hour of the night, any type of weather, to try to help people and save lives, and to throw this up in their face, I don't want that to happen for those people.
Carl Zimmerman, he's out in that Earlville area talking about the Great Lakes Basin Transportation Railroad, the GLBT. Not to be confused with LGBT, this is the GLBT. That may be in the news quite a bit, too, and the months ahead. You'll hear more about that, I predict. Planting time, I talked about that with Steve Bridge, farm broadcaster down in Springfield this week. WFMB Radio is where Steve hangs out. I figured they were rolling down that direction, and Steve indicated, well, not quite just yet.
We are in a holding pattern, Max. Farmers are still looking for the optimum conditions to get this crop into the ground and off to a good start. Moisture levels, I think, are pretty good for an awful lot of farmers, but otherwise, I think the idea is soil temperatures are just still a little bit too cool, and given the impact of prices and commodity outlooks right now, I think farmers are going to be a little bit more cautious this year in getting a crop started, and so they are going to take their time.
It's interesting to hear you say that, given the fact that last year many growers just struggled to get a crop planted because of too much moisture. And one would think that this year, if it's dry enough, they're going to go, regardless of the soil temperature. But that's not the case.
Not right now. Maybe it will be in another week to 10 days. Our forecast still looks pretty cool for the next 7 to 10 days or so. But by the end of that run, I think if it's still cool, but the soil conditions are otherwise dry and mostly fit, you're going to see farmers starting to pull the trigger and getting out there, because they will, at that point in time, mid-April, be a little bit nervous. However, we've seen through seed technology and seed treatments, farmers really being able to push the envelope on those starting soil temperatures, and I think that gives farmers a little bit of a sense of confidence now when they go out to the field that if it's not quite warm enough, but if they know that the trend is upward, they're going to get out there a day or two early if they can and start putting some seed in the ground.
Steve Bridge, farm broadcaster from Springfield at WFMB Radio. We'll talk to Mr. Schwann here. I think he's standing by to do the news right after these messages. Hey, thank you for the privilege of spending a little time with you this morning here on the Saturday Morning Show. On behalf of Ori and Samuelson, I'm Max Armstrong, thanking Mr. Bob Ferguson for trying to keep this rattle trap holding together here during the past hour. We do appreciate that. Schwann, how you been? How are you, fellow Hoosier?
Good morning, fellow Hoosier. Good morning, and congratulations once again, Max. Geez, the last time I talked with you, I congratulated you on being a grandfather. Now I congratulate you on being one of the newest members of the Walk of Fame. That's just great.
It's all good stuff. It
certainly
makes for
is.
A very bright day. Thank you, sir. I do appreciate that. You've been doing all right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Everything's moving along just fine. Keeping busy, and couldn't believe that there was ice and snow on the roadways driving in this morning. But
I'm telling you.
And seriously, though, we are going to have a story here from Roger on the 13-car accident on the Eisenhower early this morning coming up in the news.
That. We appreciate it. Always good to hear you, sir.
You
always
too,
good
Max.
To talk to you.
Take
Look forward
care.
To seeing you in person one of these days.
You bet. Absolutely.
Ori and Samuelson keeps you connected to the world of business and agriculture on WGN. Hear his reports weekday mornings on The Steve Cochran Show and during the noon hour on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Plus, catch Orion and Max on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. only on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.